Growing West Mullen Fire near Superior forces more people out of their homes. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce looks at possible candidates for the U.S. Senate race. And in our feature interview, Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks with a Flathead cherry grower about the last best cherry. The Mineral County Sheriff's Office issued more evacuation orders today as temperatures rose and the humidity decreased on the West Mullen Fire burning north of Superior. Strong winds yesterday pushed the fire to over 3,600 acres. Information Officer Pat McKelvey says the fire took a big run yesterday.
It is to the road in Flat Creek, for those that are watching on a map. And it has been a good afternoon for the firefighters. Yes, visually we've got a lot of fire that's showing on the right above town, but we're able to stop it. They're doing a good job of getting fire back into the fire coming down the down that hill.
At least 100 homes have been evacuated since the fire started on Sunday, with the latest evacuations in the Keystone area near the fire.
The area to the west, that's where Keystone and La Vista are, is off of the Dry Creek exit number 43 off of I-90. The area into Keystone and La Vista will be blocked off, but access to the Slowway Road will still be allowed.
No structures have been lost so far because of the fire's spread. No traffic is being allowed north of the Clark Fork River in Superior. McKelvey says with the hot, dry forecast, the fire is going to keep growing.
Our concern today had to be right here above town. That doesn't mean that we have not done anything on the other edges of this fire, but it's going to get bigger. There's probably no question about that. We just don't want it to get bigger down here near this community.
The American Red Cross has set up an emergency evacuation center at Superior Elementary School. The Gold Creek Fire burning north of Missoula remains at 167 acres. Information Officer Mariah Lucian says over 100 firefighters are busy laying hoses and establishing anchor points on that fire.
Especially along the southern flank of the fire. And then they are continuing that saw line, and then today also carrying in some hose lays in there as well, and getting water to both the entire southern flank of the fire, moving to the north and wrapping around the northwest edge of the fire as well.
That fire is not threatening any structures, but has forced the closure of several trails in the Gold Creek area.
And in other news from around the state, the body of a 23-year-old solo hiker has been found near the summit of an 11,000-foot mountain in Yellowstone National Park. The National Park Service says Joseph Austin Parker was originally from Valdosta, Georgia, but most recently has been working in Gardner, Montana. The agency says Parker was reported missing at about 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, about 5 hours after he called his friends, saying he was descending Electric Peak because of nearby lightning. An aerial and ground search turned up nothing this morning when his body was discovered below the summit of Electric Peak. The cause of death is under investigation. Electric Peak is located in the Gallatin Range in the northwest corner of Yellowstone.
And a 73-year-old southwestern Montana man has died while fishing in Yellowstone. The National Park Service says the man, whose name has not been released, lost his footing while fishing in the Yellowstone River and was swept away in the swift current yesterday. The incident occurred near the Nez Perce picnic ground in the Mud Volcano area of the park. The Park Service says witnesses reported seeing the man trying to cross the river in chest-deep water. He was carried about 200 yards downstream before another visitor pulled him out and tried unsuccessfully to revive him. The cause of death is under investigation.
Two adults and a child were injured after lightning struck nearby as they hiked on a trail in Glacier National Park. Though unrelated, the three were hiking together and were taken to Kalispell Regional Medical Center. Hospital spokesman Jim Oliverson tells the Daily Interlake the three remain hospitalized today in serious but stable condition. A ranger called park dispatchers at about 4:30 p.m. yesterday to report the apparent strike on the St. Mary's Falls Trail on the east side of the park. Bystanders successfully administered CPR, and the victims, who were initially unconscious, were carried on litters to the trailhead. The child was flown to the hospital while the adults were put on an ambulance. The helicopter returned and picked up the man while the woman continued on to the hospital in the ambulance. Other than the victims, park rangers believe that no one witnessed the incident.
This weekend's Bannock Day celebration has been canceled after floodwater swept rocks, tree limbs, and mud through the main street of the tourist attraction. The flash flood arrived suddenly yesterday evening while about 20 people were touring Montana's first territorial capital, which is now a preserved ghost town and a state park featuring attractions from Montana's Gold Rush past. The visitors were safely evacuated, with one person suffering a cut on the knee that did not require medical attention. One historic building was washed away and others were damaged. Park officials were still assessing the extent of the damage and estimated the park will be closed for at least 2 weeks.
The list of Democratic candidates who may decide to run for either the U.S. House or Senate continues to evolve. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer shocked Montana's political world last weekend when he announced he would not run for the Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus in 2014. Up until then, he had been the favorite. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says there are a lot of maybes for new candidates, but that's it.
Former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger says he was as surprised as everyone else by his running mate's weekend announcement.
I was stunned.
He picked up the phone.
He didn't pick up, but I did leave a message.
Bollinger says Schweitzer did call him back and said what he's pretty much been saying. He doesn't want to live in Washington, D.C. and work for a body he sees as dysfunctional, the U.S. Senate. Bollinger says he then started receiving calls asking him to run.
You've been our lieutenant governor for 8 years. You had 6 years in our House of Representatives, 6 years in our Senate, and we like the way you think.
He joined Schweitzer's gubernatorial ticket as a Republican, but his time in office put him at odds with the state party. He says the GOP of today is nothing like the one he joined in the early 90s. The 77-year-old Bollinger describes himself as a moderate. He says he still has the energy and the health for a 6-year term, and he says he would have no problem running as a Democrat. Yet right now, it's all considerations.
I'm in the process of discernment. I've got to evaluate this as an opportunity.
And that's where many potential candidates say they are. Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juno is thinking about it. Reportedly, so are current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh, Bozeman Representative Frankie Wilmer, and President of the abortion rights organization Emily's List, Stephanie Shriok. State Auditor Monica Lindeen had been considering a bid but quickly changed her mind this week. It's pretty much in the air. The Republican side of the Senate race is more concrete. Two candidates now, former state senator and gubernatorial candidate Corey Stapleton and currently serving state representative Champ Edmonds. But it's widely expected Republican Congressman Steve Daines will jump into the Senate race, where he would likely be the frontrunner. That may lead both Edmonds and Stapleton to switch to the House seat being vacated by Daines if he does leave it. No Democrats have announced in the House race either. Lee Newspapers reports one of Senator Baucus's top aides, John Lewis, is looking at the race. Other Democratic groups are encouraging first-term Butte Representative Amanda Curtis to run. Curtis won favor with Democrats this past legislative session for posting detailed recaps of her actions and reflections to YouTube every day of the session.
I know that a lot of people in Montana feel like they already know me because I have made such a concrete record of who I am as a person and as a politician.
Curtis works as a high school math teacher in Butte. She says it's humbling to be asked about the House race. 3 years ago, she wasn't plugged into the political scene at all.
Feels like just the very next day, my name is seriously being considered for a congressional run. It feels pretty surreal.
And like many other potential candidates, it's something she needs to take the time to think over. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The State Board of Regents has voted to broaden the university system's anti-discrimination policy to require campuses to ensure there's no discrimination based on gender identity or sexual orientation. Board members voted 4-0 in a conference call Monday to add the new wording. The policy previously prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, creed, political ideas, sex, age, marital status, physical or mental disability, national origin, or ancestry. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports 7 of the state's campuses had earlier barred discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Commissioner of Higher Education Clayton Christian says the university system will designate more restrooms as family, unisex, or handicap accessible. It says it sends the proper message that the state's campuses are open, welcoming, safe places to attend for any Montana students.
State wildlife officials say 7 bighorn sheep have been killed on western Montana highways over the past week. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks officials said yesterday that 5 bighorns were killed along Montana Highway 200 east of Bonner, one in Lower Rock Creek, and one on U.S. Highway 93 near the East Fork of the Bitterroot River. No people were reported injured. Wildlife biologist Vicki Edwards says several roadways cross through bighorn sheep habitat, and the sheep are attracted to roadways for salt. They also are attracted to irrigated pastures and lawns for green vegetation. FWP urges motorists traveling through areas with bighorn sheep to anticipate sheep merging onto roadways without warning. Edwards says the animals are not always wary of traffic.
The Missoula County Sheriff's Office is investigating a break-in at a residence east of Missoula in which the burglar got away with more than $6,000 worth of silver, a coin collection, and a .22 caliber pistol. The burglary occurred yesterday between noon and 6 p.m. at a residence in Tura, which is about 8 miles east of Missoula. The thief or thieves got away with 315 ounces of silver, including two 100-ounce bars and a coin collection that included Indian head pennies and buffalo nickels. The sheriff's office has no suspects. Anyone with information is asked to call the Missoula County Sheriff's Office at 406-258-4810 or Five Valleys Crime Stoppers at 406-721-4444.
From Polson north to Big Fork, cherry stands, which have remained shuttered throughout the year, are just opening up as the cherry harvest starts in Montana. Some of the growers along the east shore of Flathead Lake are hobby growers with a couple of acres of orchard in their yards, scaling down toward the lake or up to the edge of the mountains. Many pool their resources and their cherries as part of the Flathead Lake Cherry Growers Cooperative. Earlier this week, harvest started on the first Flathead cherries of the season. In tonight's feature interview, Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks with board member Ked Edgington about this year's crops and Lambert, Rainier, Lapin, and Sweetheart cherries. He says the Lamberts were first brought to Montana in 1893.
They first started to try to grow them in the Bozeman area, but the weather conditions and everything, soil was not quite right. So after a few years, they decided that it was easier to grow cattle over there than cherries. And cherries moved into the Flathead Valley, and the cherry trees love it over here.
What is it about this part of the world, especially here we are on the east shore of Flathead Lake? What is it about here?
Well, it's a lot about the soil conditions. Cherry trees like a rocky soil that's well drained. They don't like to have their roots sit in standing water very long. And, of course, Montana soil over here is very conducive to that. The other thing is that because of the Flathead Lake, a lot of places in Montana would be very almost too cold in order to keep the trees through the wintertime. They would die out. But here, we have the luxury of having the winds come out of the west, and it picks up the heat off of the lake, and it keeps this the temperature and the climate in this part of the valley. It keeps it very conducive to keeping the cherry trees alive during the winter. Even though they go into dormancy, it's not going to freeze out and kill them.
It just stays that much warmer?
Yeah, we can be between here and Big Fork, Montana, if it's we can be 7 to 8 degrees warmer than what you'll see in Big Fork, and of course that translates to quite a few more degrees than what they get in Kalispell.
7 to 8 degrees. I mean, that may not sound like much, but that's a lot.
It's a lot for a tree. It makes the difference whether they stay alive or they die.
So right now, this time of year, what is happening with the cherry orchards?
We're coming right up on harvest season right now. Up until now, we've pruned the trees in the dead of winter when they're in dormancy. That's when you prune them, and then along about May, they pop out their blooms, and the bees come in and to help pollinate. And then you start to see some little green things hanging there, so you know you have some cherries out there this year. And then from then on out, it's a matter of watering them if Mother Nature doesn't provide enough herself until you get to the July season, and obviously then we have to irrigate now. And you apply fertilizer in the spring, and it's basically a weight game at that point in time. And the way it works is down at Findlay Point, the orchards that are down to the Findlay Point area, they usually will harvest first because for some reason the climate down there, those trees just mature a little before, let's say, Yala Bay here. And it just kind of progresses up the lake. You can almost follow it. And from about now, which we're in what, mid-July, through about mid-August, there'll be harvesting going on in most of the orchards.
What are the varieties, again, that are grown in Flathead?
The first variety that we'll be picking, starting the earliest, are the Lamberts, and that is the cherry tree that was brought to the Flathead. And for years and years and years, it was the primary tree. There are some Rainiers, the yellow cherries, that are grown over here, too. And those will harvest a little bit after the Lamberts. They're not early cherries. Then another cherry that proved to be very hardy in the valley over here that harvests right after the Lamberts is called the Lapin. And it's a large cherry. It gets large, and the nice thing about it is sometimes when it rains, it's not as susceptible to cracking like the Lambert might be. It's a little tougher cherry. I mean tougher in order to withstand the rain. So it would probably be the second variety that would harvest. And then the later variety that a lot of the orchards are starting to grow over here now is a new cherry called the Sweetheart. And that's the cherry that would be harvesting, let's say, from about the first, second week in August on into the middle, depending upon where you are on the shore here.
And you say new. How new? How recent has that been?
Well, Washington had been growing probably Sweethearts for the last 6, 7, 8 years. A lot of growers over here started trying the Sweetheart, let's say, 5 years ago, 5, 6 years ago. Washington was a little ahead of us on that, but we got a start on it because for many years, Montana has always been the latest cherry that you can get in the United States. Otherwise, because of the climate and our altitude over here, we always could say we're the last best cherry, you know. But with Washington starting to grow varieties at their higher elevations, which would push their cherries off a little bit, they are starting to encroach on us a little bit. So what we want to do over here is encourage growers to put in the later varieties too, so we can keep pushing ourselves out, so we can always claim to be the last cherries available in the United States.
How is the crop looking this year in the Flathead?
The crop looks good this year so far. It's going to be down from last year, just like Washington's crop was down. And that's not all bad. We, like Washington, had some very cold snap early in the season, about bloom time or just shortly thereafter. And that thinned out some of the bloom on the tree. So we knew right away we had experienced a similar thing that Washington had. And sometimes thinning out the crop a little bit is not all bad, because what today the consumer is looking for big cherries. And where before, it was the size was not as important. People didn't so much buy with their eyes. They bought from the taste. And so if the tree becomes what we call overset, that when you say a tree is set well, that means it has a lot of cherries on it. So thinning the crop out a little bit will help produce larger cherries, and that's good for the grower because most of us down here produce cherries for what's called the fresh pack market. That means the pickers, when they harvest the cherry off the tree, they must take it off the tree with the stem still attached, because it's not going to be canned, it's not going to be frozen, it's going to show up in the supermarket. They're in a box, beautifully red, with the green stem still on it, and that's the way people eat it. And that's the way a grower can probably make the best return on growing cherries, is try to grow for the fresh pack market.
It matters to have a pretty cherry.
Yes, it does. It's cosmetics are what everything's about, isn't it?
Now, you had said that there are a couple things, you know, you kind of made it through the frost. There was that cold snap, but that really is not necessarily that bad a thing, because you're going to get, you know, big cherries, not too overcrowded. But there are some other concerns that you have this time of year, namely rain.
Well, we have two concerns. Mother Nature is obviously the big one, because we do not want to have rain, if we can possibly stave it off. We don't want to have rain right when you're starting to try to harvest the cherry, or just a few days prior to that. We try to compensate for that because we keep a couple helicopters on standby, and so if we do get rain, they can come immediately and hover over the trees and blow a lot of that water out of the tree and get it off the cherry. Because what happens is, if that water remains on the cherry tries to take it into its skin. And when it tries to take it into its skin, it's already close to harvest anyway, so it just kind of pops open, it causes a crack in the cherry. And of course, cosmetically, then it won't qualify for fresh pack. It might be still a perfectly great cherry to eat. If you buy them roadside or something like that, a little crack in the cherry is nothing to get too concerned about. But except it will not sell on the commercial market if it has to be transported a long way and be processed and packaged and then transported onto the ultimate retailer.
Now, when you first told me that you guys had helicopters on standby, I thought you were pulling my leg. You're not pulling my leg?
No, we're not pulling your leg. If it rains, jump in your car and come down here real fast. You'll probably see them.
Because, can you tell me how that works with the helicopter?
Well, a helicopter, anybody that knows, a helicopter has a downdraft, and it's pushing air down to keep it up in the sky. And these guys, both these guys that come back, we use the same people every year. They're very knowledgeable how far to stay above the tree so you don't blow the branches out of the tree, because the downdraft off a helicopter is really monumental. I mean, if he gets too close to the tree, it can break limbs right out of the tree. So they'll have, they'll be usually 15, 20 feet maybe above the trees. And the downdraft from the helicopter blows the water straight to the ground. And we're hopeful that it also gets the water out of what's called the cup of the cherry. On the very top of the cherry where the stem is attached, there's a little indentation that's called the cup. And if water sits in there very long before it gets blown out, it'll form a little brown ring in the top of it. And obviously, cosmetically, that's not acceptable for fresh pack. It hasn't hurt the cherry really at all, except cosmetically, it's not perfect. And so that will hurt you, because that cherry will be sold for other reasons other than fresh pack.
And so starting to harvest in Findlay Point, you know a couple orchards tomorrow. What about here, Yellow Bay? When will they make it up here, do you think?
Yellow Bay, we will probably start, our best guesstimate right now is probably like maybe next Monday.
And then you said the crop looks like it's going to be good, but not as big as last year.
No, Washington's crop was off this year, too. They received rain, not only the same kind of weather we did early in the game, but they received a lot of rain in certain areas that grow a lot of cherries over there right at harvest time. So some of those orchards, their cherries got split so badly that the grower just did not pick the orchard. So their crop is going to be down, and ours is going to be down too, because we had the weather they did. But that's good in a way. Like I said, sometimes it thins out the crop, but now we don't have a glut of cherries this year. So the market, the demand will be great. It won't be a glut. So the price has held up very well so far, not only for the Washington growers that managed to be able to get some of their crop off, or all their crop, but for us too. We see the price staying healthy this year because of the supply and demand.
Well, I've been speaking with Ken Edgington of Yellow Bay, and I just really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect clear skies with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs in the upper 80s to mid 90s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly clear skies with lows around 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow expect sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with lows in the lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs around 80 to 90 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Diana Moneta.
Three weeks ago, President Obama laid out his long-awaited plan to address climate change. As he put it in a speech to college students, "I refuse to condemn your generation and future generations to a planet that's beyond fixing." Key components of the president's plan include limiting carbon pollution from power plants and increasing the production of renewable energy. This has major implications for electric utilities across the U.S. Last week, the CEO of Montana's largest utility, Northwestern Energy, indicated in an interview that the utility will take future limits on carbon pollution into account in its planning process. That's a smart move for future generations, not to mention current utility customers. Northwestern is also required by state law to obtain 15% of its power from renewable sources by 2015, and it's on track to do that. Unfortunately, Northwestern Energy has been less supportive of opportunities for homeowners and business owners to invest in their own small renewable energy systems, like rooftop solar panels and small wind turbines. In addition to reducing pollution, these decentralized renewable energy systems produce energy on-site, where it's used, so it doesn't have to be delivered across long-distance transmission lines. That cuts waste and increases energy security. And then there are the economic benefits. More than 50 small businesses across Montana sell and install renewable energy systems, contributing more than $10 million per year to the state's economy. And thanks to rapidly dropping solar prices, renewable energy has never been so affordable for individual Montanans. Montana law gives homeowners and business owners the right to install small solar, wind, and hydroelectric systems on their properties and hook them up to the grid in an arrangement called net metering. When a net metered customer produces more renewable energy than they need, the excess flows back onto the grid, the utility sells it to someone else, and the customer receives a credit on their power bill. Incentives are also available through Northwestern Energy to encourage investment in small solar and wind systems. It's a good program, part of the Universal Systems Benefit Program that was created by state law and is funded by a surcharge on utility bills for the benefit of all utility customers. Unfortunately, despite its involvement in this program, Northwestern Energy has not been supportive of decentralized clean energy in the policy arena. During this year's legislative session, bills were introduced to increase the size limit on net metered systems and to allow apartment dwellers as well as homeowners to participate in net metering. Unfortunately, neither of these bills passed, due largely to opposition from Northwestern Energy. Their argument against net metering is based on the claim that net metered customers are subsidized by other ratepayers. In making this claim, Northwestern Energy fails to account for the very real benefits that small solar and wind systems contribute to the power grid. These systems generate electricity without pollution control costs, without costly transmission line losses, and often at times of high demand when electricity on the open market is most expensive. Indeed, studies conducted in Vermont, California, and Texas have found that net metering actually provides a net benefit rather than a cost to other utility customers. But this accounting argument actually obscures the more fundamental issue for utilities. Edison Electric Institute, the trade group of U.S. investor-owned utilities, forecast in a recent report that decentralized renewable energy has the potential to fundamentally disrupt utilities' business models. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. Utilities are regulated monopolies with a business model dictated by law. That model has been essentially unchanged for more than 100 years, but the world is changing around it. We need a fundamental restructuring of the utility business model to remove the disincentive for utilities to accommodate decentralized renewable energy as one component of a cleaner, more modern energy system. To get there, we'll all have to be on board. Utilities, public service commissions, policymakers, and consumers of electricity, like you and me. Utilities are key here, certainly, but so are consumers. We aren't passive ratepayers anymore. We increasingly have the opportunity to manage our own consumption of energy and to produce our own clean power. If you have an interest in renewable energy, you won't want to miss the opportunity to learn more this Saturday at the 3rd Annual Clean Energy Fair in Butte. The Clean Energy Fair is free and open to the public and will feature an all-day schedule of workshops on topics including solar, wind, micro-hydropower, biodiesel, and other technologies, as well as keynote speaker Governor Steve Bullock. There will also be a hybrid and electric car show, live music, and kids' activities. The fair takes place this Saturday, July 20th, from 9 to 4 at the National Center for Appropriate Technology in Butte. For details, visit montanarenewables.org. In Missoula, I'm Diana Mineta for the Montana Renewable Energy Association and the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. Aero has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit Aero online at aeromt.org.
Diana Mineta is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join us tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.